All right, welcome back to another episode of Web3 Builders. Today we have Dan from Risk Finance. I'm Evan Van Ness. Will's with me. Dan, let's start off with the standard podcast question. You know, like going into your background, what in your background led you to doing Risk Finance, which, by the way, is on-chain options?
Yeah, thanks, guys, for having me. Thanks, everyone. So let me start with, as you said, like background and bio. But I started my career, I was doing investment banking. So, you know, that was the first step. I was doing M&A or like, you know, corporate banking. So it was like not actually trading, not options, but, you know, in the finance world. That was in around like 2011, 2012. So it was like right after the big crisis. And
Dan, the finance, suit, you've changed quite a
like,
bit since
yeah,
then.
Yeah, I was like going around with a suit with my, you know, Ferragamo.
Wearing a soccer jersey now.
And now I'm like, you know, this is me. But that's also probably one of the things about finance. It's like I liked finance. It was fun. I'm not going to lie. I think the environment back then, also because it was like very high regulated after the crisis, it was like a lot of bureaucracy. And not going to lie, my probably like 60, 70% of my job was like internal committee, get things approved. Like, especially I was working in the Italian office. Italy wasn't in its best shape. So like high risk of, you know, default. So every time like you want to do anything, it was like you have to go to internal committees and so on. So like that was, again, I like finance, but the work wasn't in actually finance. But something I wanted to do, you know, I was probably like a big nerd and wanted to go deeper into tech, and I wanted to learn coding. I was like, I love tech space. I don't know how to code. I think I can do it. So I quit finance, started to learn coding. So got myself, you know, one of sabbatical time to learn coding. And then since then, I've basically been working in startups all the time, like mostly as a co-founder. So it was like one of the biggest I had. It was like this Italian company. We were doing online education software as a service for, you know, education and everything. And I was like, you know, founder, CTO of that one. Obviously, being in tech and especially around 2016, 2017, I was also living in Berlin. And Berlin back then was the best place for crypto and especially Ethereum environment. So I remember like going to this, you know, like meetups with the Gnosis Safe people, and you know, Berlin community was pretty big back then. So I got curious.
This is actually news to me that you lived in Berlin, and as an investor in Risk Finance, I feel like I should have done that due diligence before I invested.
Well, I mean, I guess it's like that's one of the privacy thing that people shouldn't disclose all the time, right? But yeah, no, I was living in Berlin for like a year, like almost 3 years at the end. It was like such a great place to live. Back then, it was like super cheap compared to other, you know, European cities. Great vibe, like all this, you know, like Ethereum movement was popping up. And so, yeah, I got like pretty much excited about crypto, but mostly, you know, I just buy some token, like back then it was Ethereum, see what's going on, but I didn't really build something on top of it. I got way more excited around the bear market in 2018. So that was like the first time that I was like, okay, this is getting interesting. Like all the ICO thing was over. And I was like, this is actually like pretty cool because I can see some financial applications. So like one of the protocol I got interested in, for example, was Aave, ETHLAND, I guess, back then. I went to like, I think it was some like eParis 2018 or 2019. I don't remember. Like I was doing the hackathon there, talking with Stani about open finance. And I was like, okay, this is actually very interesting. This is like a good application of my background. And so then I actually got more involved. Done a couple of hackathon as a, you know, as a side. And in 2020, that was like the day that I was living in Milan, and lockdown for COVID was crazy. It was like one of the places I couldn't even leave my building. And so I had spare time, like, you know, you're home with nothing else to do. And so I was like, okay, I like crypto. It was, you know, back early 2020, and I discovered Open, the options protocol. And I was like, okay, this is very interesting. I like DeFi. I like Open as a concept, and the options was one of those products that I was pretty curious about it. And so, you know how it is. Like I got into Discord, started to chat with them, gave them a couple of feedback, and then I became a friend with them. And eventually I became an advisor and like a contributor. So I was like very active with them in the spare time, you know, because I still had my business. At some point, what I've realized about the options market is that Open was a settlement layer. So it was a very good protocol for creating tokens, but it was hard to attract liquidity. And back then, Open was an order book. It was using 0x as an order book on top of Open. And that product was very hard because liquidity was very fragmented. It was hard to get, you know, like a lot of users, and options are a very interesting instrument. And, you know, it's, we can talk about later about specifically options. So the idea was, let's try to build like an AMM on top of this Open infrastructure to have liquidity sourced by a pool instead of an order book, right? Because in this way, we can solve this liquidity issue. So that's how we started with Risk. I met my co-founders in the Open Discord. I think I disclosed this to Evan on the first due diligence call, if you can call it that way. We met in the Open Discord. We started to brainstorm ideas. We've done an hackathon. And then at some point, it was like, okay, now it's time to, you know, put this, you know, on a different level. So quit everything I was doing, 100% of Risk. And the idea was, let's build kind of like an options market on top of this Open infrastructure. So that's how I got into, you know, full-time builder at Risk. And Risk today is exactly that. It's like basically, it is an options protocol with an AMM pricing mechanism where anyone can go there and trade options, and the counterpart is effectively like the pool and the AMM.
Risk is the only, I think it was the first deal I did at Starbloom. And I think it's one of the few deals where I have ever even taken a phone call off of a cold DM. So it can work.
Although good DM skills.
Yeah, pretty unlikely too. Yeah, I had a call with y'all. I couldn't figure out whether you were pseudonymous at the time, which was sort of funny. And eventually I found out when I got the legal docs that you were not.
We at the beginning, like, we were like, especially some people in the team, was like, let's try to be pseudonymous. There's nothing wrong to start like that, right? And then if we need to get, you know, on the full docs, we can always go there. But if you do the other way around, it's not going to work. So that's how we still have some people in the team that are like pseudo in that sense. You know, we hang out in real life, we know them, but they try to not disclose, you know, their name or where they live, like stuff like that. And I guess that's fine. So yeah.
You also, you're the, you know, you said you were the CTO of your previous startup. But I think you're at the point now where you're the business guy of Risk, and you're not allowed to touch the code base anymore. How's that transition been?
I think I'm just getting older, probably. You know, I'm the wise of the group, and it's like, you know, just... No, the real story is I was a CTO. I was pretty deep into Web 2, and I've been doing that for a long time. I never really got deep into smart contracts, to be honest. I wrote some of them for hackathons and so on, but never really got very deep into it. And when we started Risk, out of the three co-founders, the other two were smart contracts dev, with, like, you know, very good, very talented. And so at that point, I also, you know, like, I think coding is one of those things that when you get, I'm serious, like, when you get, like, older, like, it's like, do I go deep 100% into that, or, like, use my more, you know, experience and so on. And, you know, I understand coding, I understand everything, but I can use that more like on a BD level, or, you know, more like managerial, if you can call it that way. And I also, probably the way I am, I'd like to change. I like to get new challenges. And so I was like, you know, let's try to do more BD stuff. So that's what I do now. Like, I'm the business guy, but I still talk with them on a regular basis. I understand them. If we need to hire a new engine, I do interviews. Like, you know, I understand that. I write some basic code that review PRs for, you know, front end, or like, kind of like, I'm doing also like kind of product management now, especially on the front end level, not on the smart contract. So I review PRs there. I give inputs on what to keep priority and so on. But yeah, I'm the business guy. And I think the transition was pretty natural. Like, at some point I was like, I don't know if I want to focus on code every day. I love it. I think it's one of the cool skills to have, but yeah.
Yeah, one thing I want to go back to is actually our last podcast. We had Vitalik on, and he talked about how, like, DeFi was super oversaturated. Cool thing is that, like, you've been doing it since, like, you know, the early days when we were still talking about, like, open finance versus DeFi, and, like, they still didn't really, like, have a name on it. Tell me a little bit, like, how you've seen that transition from, like, 2019, 2020 until now, and, like, the amount of projects we have out there.
If, you know, probably like what Vitalik was mentioning and referring to, it was like we built a lot of the financial infrastructure on the base layer, and probably like everything on top of that, like DeFi derivatives and everything, a product that we might don't need as DeFi. Probably that's some consideration that I guess we can discuss about it. But if we need them and if we want them as a DeFi product, there is a lot to do at every level. And so I guess there is still a lot to build. And the more I'm in the space, the more I believe that the challenges are very high from every perspective. But the more I believe that we need a DeFi product for that. Because what happened with FTX, and again, 2022 was like, you know, one of those crazy years. It makes you think that we need a DeFi version of FTX or a derivatives product, because what happened there is like it cannot just happen. Like we need to avoid that, right? So I think it's not easy. I think it will take a long time. Again, we are in a point of time where even stable coins are not stable anymore, or the ones that we thought they were stable. So I think it will take a lot of time to build all the pieces up above that. But I think it's needed for a better financial system. And that's what brought me, you know, into the space. So that's my view, and obviously biased from what I'm doing, but that's what I believe.
Well, so, the centralized exchanges are still the place where all options activity happens in crypto, but it is massive. And, you know, I think for a tech-focused audience, which we don't really know who our audience is, but let's pretend it's a tech-focused audience. I think a lot of people don't realize how big the centralized exchange options markets are. Can you give us about how big are those markets out there? Like, I know Deribit is massive. I know Bybit is massive. I think Deribit might even be in third place, actually.
Yeah, so, well, first thing, like, let's go to traditional finance, right? Options are crazy high. If you think about Robinhood a couple of years ago with all, you know, GameStop and everything, that was all options, right? So in traditional finance, options are a very institutional instrument, but also a strong retail instrument. And the reason for that, I believe, is if you are a retail investor, let's say right now in, I don't know, like in the States, and you want to buy something with leverage, there's no way you're going to get 100x leverage or something, but you can have leverage with options, right? So that's probably something that made options very popular, like also in retail, traditional finance, like Robinhood. Like, you want to take a position, you want to get leverage, you trade options, you long options, and that's how you get, you know, the 1000x leverage or whatever. When it comes to crypto, though, we have Deribit that is definitely the main player into the market. And Deribit volumes, compared to like DeFi right now, we're talking about like over 95% of volumes are basically Deribit and few other centralized exchanges. So DeFi compared to Deribit, it's like completely like not even close to, you know, to compete as of today. The main issue there, if I can give you my point of view, is one thing is like Deribit. It's obviously a very good product that has been in the space for a long time now. And they, because of decentralization, they are able to do, like, for example, very good capital efficiency, margining. So if you're like a sophisticated user, if you're like a market maker, if you are like an institutional, you can trade on something like that a bit. And, you know, it's especially like on capital efficiency, it's definitely a big thing. And to give you a number, like if you want to sell an option, let's say a call option, 1 week expiry, out of the money. So it means like, you know, a strike that is not close to the current spot. On Deribit, you need something like 0.1 ETH, something like that, as collateral for one option. In DeFi, on average, if you get something like below $600-$700, it's like, it's probably like something wrong. So usually you get like $600-$700 and so on. So if you think about it, this is like 5x way more collateralized than something like that a bit, right? And collateralization to me is one of the biggest, because again, if you have one ETH and on basically that a bit, you can sell 10 options, and on DeFi you sell one, it makes a huge difference, because, you know, it's how it is. And that's what sophisticated users are looking for. But are we going there? Yes, just a matter of time, technology. And but something I like to add here, and then I'll let you go for the next question, is when you actually look at crypto, options is not the main derivative. The main derivative in crypto is still perpetuals. And that's something very important to know, because perpetuals, my understanding of, you know, users and their things, that perpetual is what I was mentioning before, is the 100x leverage that you cannot get in traditional finance, but you can get it in crypto because of, you know, different regulations and everything. And it's a very retail friendly product, because options, they require complexity. Like, you need to understand them. They are complex by design. It's not options are complex, you know, because we want them to be complex. It's a design of the option. If you're a sophisticated, you'll enjoy trading options, because you can put a lot of your alpha into it. You can put a lot of edge. Like, you can choose strikes, you can choose expiries, you can choose, you know, all the Greeks. So you can manage your risk. But when you trade a pair, there is nothing like that. It's all about timing, right? It's like, oh, I think the price is going up. Let me just get in into the right time, get 100x leverage, and that's it. So that's something to keep in mind. And I think as of today, we've seen the perps exploding. And that's probably in line with what Vitalik was saying. Like, the perp market is absolutely, like, it's great in DeFi. It's like, it's an amazing market. It's working better in DeFi than, you know, the CeFi right now, like GMX, Vertex, all those DeFi protocols. They're working great. They have traction, they have users, and so on. And so I think options, they still have a lot of opportunity to get there, but we require also users to be more sophisticated, institutionals. We need to educate them. We need to be products that simplify options. So I guess there's, yeah, a lot of work to do.
So I really first, like, figured out how big options were when I heard of, like, BitDAO, which I think has changed its name, rebranded, whatever. But BitDAO is Bybit. It's their DAO on Ethereum. They sold a token to Silicon Valley VCs 18 months ago. And they were doing something like 25 basis points of their revenue. So 0.25%, you know, a quarter of 1%. And they were donating it, or diverting it, or whatever you want to say. They were giving it to the DAO. And it was like $1 million of stablecoins a day and $1 million of ETH a day. And this was, when I looked at it, like over a year ago. So I think that's like an interesting data point for, like you say, like you didn't even mention Bybit, right? Like you said, they're not even the number one player. But like that's a pretty big data point for like how much money is out there in off-chain or like in centralized exchange options that, you know, like can be moved on chain. And, you know, like Vitalik says, like most of DeFi is built. Well, like, you know, it's all happening on centralized exchanges. And for, you know, Vitalik also said, like, you know, centralized exchanges should burn in hell. Well, like we have a big opportunity for on-chain options to really become a thing. And like, you know, you've outlined a lot of the challenges, but like, it's a real market that can happen. And, you know, maybe it won't be retail. I mean, it's a fair point, right? That like retail, in traditional finance uses options. In this market, they mostly use perpetuals. Do you have a sense of who the traders of options are on the centralized exchanges right now? Is it different than the people that are using DEXs, like something like Risk, or is it?
Yep. So something interesting about the options market is, like, I think the highest volumes in the last 2 years or so, and, you know, talking about that a bit, it was in November 2022. That was the highest volumes of options trading on Deribit. And you know what? It was the week that, you know, FTX collapsed. And the reason is people were buying protection. Like, the market was dumping. You don't know what's going on. Everyone wanted to buy its own protection, right? So centralized exchange, FTX collapse, and people going to another centralized exchange to actually buy options to protect themselves from that moment, right? That was pretty much, I guess, the, you know, the idea behind how the finance work, you know, right now.
And it's funny because you don't necessarily know that like your counterparty will be there in that crazy scenario either. So you're buying protection, but an FTX is blowing up, like the centralized exchange might blow up too.
I mean, the thing is like that a bit, I trust them, yes, but it's a trust based on the fact that I've been trading with them. I, you know, the product is good and everything, but who knows? I mean, at that time it could collapse anyway, right?
So that's a big place where on-chain options can be a big, big improvement. Like if you need protection and you want to be sure that your counterparty can't screw you because you can look at the code.
Yeah, you can look like, you know, how much collateral there is behind and everything. So that's definitely like one thing to keep in mind. But another data that I love to usually mention when it comes to options, crypto options, is 50% of Deribit volume. And here I'm talking about on average, sometimes like 35, sometimes like 55. But let's say like from 40 to 50% of Deribit volumes is done by Paradigm.co. Paradigm.co is an RFQ platform, so like request for quote, right? So the way it's working is that you are a big market maker or, you know, big hedge fund or whatever. You want to trade in size. Probably you don't have enough liquidity on the Deribit order book. So what you do, you go to Paradigm. You say, I want to sell or buy, I don't know, 1,000 options. And you're going to find another counterparty. So it's effectively like an OTC trade with settlement on Deribit, right? That is driving almost 50% of the volumes. I think the last month I checked, it was like 35 or 40%. So who's the biggest trader of option on CeFi? It's market makers or, you know, all these institutional actors coming out of this Paradigm.co. And for them, and, you know, I've been talking to basically all of them, because it's, we're not talking about a huge market, you know, market makers in crypto are, we know pretty much them. They are down to use DeFi as long as we mentioned before, the product is good. The product in a sense where, you know, collateralization is good enough, pricing is good enough, there's enough liquidity. I mean, you're going to be like, yeah, of course, if you can build something with liquidity and everything, they obviously they're going to use it. But that's the thing, it's like they No, I understand that DeFi potentially is better when it comes to, you know, not collateralization, but like transparency. And they care about it because you know how much money they lost on FTX, all of them. Like we've been reading all those people like, oh yeah, our exposure was on the double digit, a bit less than double digit. But on average, this is just my feeling and sentiment, on average, they lost 10% of the entire capital on an FTX collapse, right? So, you know, like DeFi has different risks for sure. Like you have security risks, smart contract could be, you know, hacked and everything. Yes, that's a risk. But as an institutional, the thing you want to diversify your risk. So you want to put in different protocols, different exchanges. That's what like will be an ideal scenario for, you know, a market maker or an institutional actor. So I guess, again, as long as we are able to build a better product that will use it, probably not going to move all their volumes into it, probably not. But even if they move 50% of the volume, they just reduce the, you know, risk of one single counterparty, that it could be a centralized exchange. So that's, I guess, the direction. And when you think about who's trading options, it's basically them. On the other side, that is very interesting to me. When you look at 2021, top of the bull market, and if you look at like the most successful options protocol back then, they were structured products. And structured products are a way of have retail participations into options market without actually knowing that they're trading options. That was like, you know, that was like very simple product. You deposit money and this vault is trading like, you know, a covered call or pools or whatever it is, the strategy, right? And they would have bought, at some point, the TVL of those products was like 200, 300 mil TVL. And it's pretty big. And that was like retail participation into the options market. So I guess one big challenge that we have in the future is like, how can we have retail participations into options market with removing the complexity of the options? So you as a user, you can still trade in options because you're using some protocol that is doing it for you, for example. So, you know, you can put money into a protocol and this protocol can hedge using like, you know, another protocol or everything on chain and DeFi oriented. So I guess that's also one of my bet. As long as DeFi is going to grow and it's going to get, you know, more sophisticated, options is going to be the base layer for risk management because it's still the best way to manage the risk. And in that sense, retail users can participate in the options market, not directly. And that's, I think, is going to be something that most of those people are sometimes missing about, like, this composability. Composability is not just a fancy word. It's something that enables any protocol to do, you know, on-chain risk management with all transparency, knowing, like, all, you know, the exposure and everything. And it's obviously a big thing, because risk management is, at the end of the game, is what made blow up most of, you know, those actors in finance in the history, right?
Well, earlier you said, you know, you talked a lot about the necessity of reducing the capital, like of making it more capital efficient. Is that, I mean, I take it you talked to the market makers. So you're saying that's the number one thing that they care about is capital efficiency. Like, it's not necessarily that they can't get the size right now on on-chain DeFi options, or is it like the pricing, you know, the slip, which has to do with sizing as well, right? But like, is it just down to capital efficiency? Is their big thing?
Capital efficiency is the main thing, because everything else could be seen as a consequence of the capital efficiency, right? So in a balanced market where you have a lot of sellers and a lot of buyers, that's how you create the volumes, right? That's how you create the liquidity. The problem that we see today, for example, on risk, is like everyone is going long because you don't need capital. You don't need to lock capital, right? So if you buy an option, you just pay premium, so you can do that. And the pool right now is the counterparty. So the liquidity is coming from what we have in terms of, you know, the USDC right now deposited into the pool. But if you have sellers, what is going to happen is that you're going to have enough sellers selling into the pool, and then you're going to have buyers that what they do, they buy options that other sellers sold it into the pool. So basically, you're not even potentially in a, you know, in a very idealistic scenario, you don't even use the liquidity into the pool in terms of like USDC for collateral. You are using other people selling, right?
Sorry, just to clarify for our audience, when you say long and short here, you mean of the underlying, or you mean, which is ETH in this case, or do you mean of the options? I think that's probably
Option.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the thing about option is, just to give you an overview, like when you long an option, it doesn't mean that you're long in the market, because you can long a put option and effectively you are short in the market. You're betting that the market is collapsing. If you long a call option, you're betting that the market is going up, right? That's like in a very simple way. When you short an option, it's actually the other way around, right? So if you short a call, you're betting that the market is going down. If you're shorting a put, you're betting that the market is going up, right? So the problem when you short
an option can also just mean selling an option.
It can get
complicated for the non-finance market pretty fast. Just so I want to make sure to clarify some stuff in here.
Yeah, selling and shorting is basically you're selling an option or you're shorting an option is the same thing. But
believe
it
or not, I did the CFA exams back in the day. I was surprised to hear that. So
and law school for a bit. Talented guy.
That's something interesting we didn't know about. I have it right here. But yeah, when you sell an option, you need to lock collateral, because when you sell, options are very interesting instrument. You basically have leverage in that sense that is not linear, but it's convex leverage. So what is the difference? Like, instead of having an instrument that is going like this, you basically have a curve like this, right? So potentially when you long an option, you get this kind of like free leverage, and it can get you like some like exposure that basically is like quadratic exposure or like, you know, square exposure, something like that. So the thing is, if you're selling on the other side, you need to make sure that it's going to be enough collateral to cover this kind of leverage that you're giving to the user that is long, right? So that's why right now we require a lot of collateral. And this means, as I mentioned before, if you want to sell an option, Deribit or centralized exchanges are way, way better. You lock one ETH and you sell 10. So your premium is going to be 10x, and you know your ROI is going to be 10x because you sold more. Also, the risk is going to be 10x. But that's a different story. But that's what a market maker is doing. Market maker is all about capital efficiency. They have limited capital, and they want to get the max out of it, the good and the bad, because we saw some market makers, you know, doing the crazy thing as it happened for 3AC or like other names, right? But that's how financial world, you know, is built on. And again, I think that's something that happens. So what I'm saying is like, if you can build a system that is capital efficient, that means that you're going to have more sellers. And so when buyers want to buy, they can either buy from sellers or in our case, as risk is built, you can buy from the pool effectively. So if you want to do size, you can do it as long as you have a very well-balanced market with a lot of sellers. And one thing about option selling is, you know, from the description I gave to people are going to be like, why people should sell an option, right? It seems like very risky. But historically, if you look at the option sellers make the money. And it's simple as an insurance company. As an insurance company, what you do, you're pricing the risk of something going wrong, right? So as long as you price this risk by pricing those options with a premium that is taking the risk into consideration, and in this case, what you're basically betting is like, I'm going to bet that the market is going to be less volatile than I'm pricing in. So if I believe that volatility is going to be 100% the next month, I'm just going to price 105. And because of this 5%, you know, difference, that's how I'm going to make money. And historically, selling options is profitable business, like insurance. Insurance is the same thing. Like, why you should sell, you know, insurance to cars or whatever, because you're pricing the risk. And so to have, and usually the sellers are more institutionals, are more sophisticated, are more like, you know, kind of systematic type of businesses. While on the other side, the buyer are like, I want to make a bet. Let me just go giga long, buy a call option because I believe price is going to moon, or people that want to hedge. And if you want to hedge, you're actually down to have a loss, right? If you're buying an insurance on the price of it going down, it's like, you know, I'm going to pay something for the insurance. If I'm going to lose money on it, it means the ETH is going up. So probably you're making money with, you know, the underlying going up. So options market is a very interesting one. But that's what you need. Like, you need sellers, and sellers are the smart guys here in this space. So you need the sellers, because otherwise,
anyway.
Yeah, but yeah, that's, you know. So that's why I believe that as long as you have a very good capital efficiency, you're gonna have more sellers, you're gonna have more sizes, you're gonna have more liquidity, you're gonna have better pricing. Like, it's all on a cascade. But that's the first step. If you cannot solve the first step, all the others are like kind of secondary issues at this point.
I want to ask about prices really quick. So one thing that I've seen is a lot of people trying to figure out how to like make an AMM or an RFQ model for DeFi that allows for better price execution, which seems to be the holy grail in a lot of ways. I mean, you're saying capital efficiency here, but from a lot of people I've spoken with, it's like, well, why would I trade on this DeFi exchange? I'm, you know, taking a bath every time I trade on there because the execution's so terrible. So approaching from that standpoint, how are you guys looking at it with options, and how much does price execution matter with these sort of options contracts, where if I'm already just insuring something in the future and I'm already sort of taking a gamble that that contract is priced correctly into the future? What sort of components are you guys looking at to price these contracts correctly?
Yeah. So pricing is obviously, again, it is a super important thing, right? Like, you don't want to get wrecked with pricing because it's completely out of the market. So, but in a system like what we built, this is an AMM, right? So the pricing is built by different components. The main one, let's say, is the base layer. It's basically just trying to have pricing the volatility on the different asset. Because when you price an option, everything you're pricing is the probability of the option to expire, so, you know, at the strike price that you choose. So let's say that today Ethereum is, you know, 1,600 right now. If you have to price, what is the probability of Ethereum to be 2,000 a month from now? That's how you price option. Simple as that. You can use different standard. Like, the main one is Black-Scholes. It's been like around as a pricing model for like years and years. I think like 40, 50 years now. That's how we basically price this probability. But it's all about probability gain. The more the market is volatile, the higher is this probability, right? So what happened right now is, like, if you look at the last few months, what is the probability of Ethereum to go to 2,000? You're going to be like, none. Like, it never happened in the last 3 months. Why should it happen tomorrow, right? Like, there is no way. But if I ask you the same question in a time where Ethereum is going to 2,000 like every week and getting back to 1,600, you're going to be like, oh yeah, probably this high because it happened like so many times often. So it's all about volatility. The more the volatile the asset, the more expensive is going to be the option. If the option is more expensive, again, you're going to have more sellers because they get more premium and blah, blah, blah. So pricing, it matters a lot. But when it comes to options, because we have this kind of standardized way of pricing, the way we price option is, again, like a base layer, it's all about implied volatility. So what is the market pricing volatility right now? That's what matters the most. And then on top of that, we add different variables. So for example, what is the exposure of the pool? So let's say that the pool is overexposed towards like a single instrument. We price that higher because we don't want to get more risk on board for our LPs, right? That's like a specific about like risk system. So it happens sometimes that price are be off, but by being off, it actually generates an arbitrage opportunity for people to put it down. But what happened right now is this arbitrage opportunity is most of the time not big enough for the collateral required. Because if everyone is buying, the price is going up, selling is actually profitable because like you can have like a better price compared to derivative. And this is something that we see on a daily basis. So you're going to be like, okay, I should short or sell on risk and I'm going to go long or buy on derivative. And this is like a risk-free, assuming no hacks and nothing like that. But let's say it's a risk-free strategy, but you still need to lock collateral. So you need to lock, I don't know, $500, $600 to sell on risk. And so people are going to be like, I'm not going to lock $600 to get a $2 arbitrage, right? But if the arbitrage is 10, you're going to be, okay, that's a good deal. And so you can see we're reaching this, you know, equilibrium over there. The other thing that matters a lot is this spread. So risk as any model is built on, you know, a bid and ask spread. And our spread is actually dynamic. So the more liquidity you have, the tighter the spread and the better. So I think your point on price is right. Like people want a good price and they want a tight spread. Because if you buy an option, you don't want to lose like 20% of the value just because the bid and the ask is so wide. Like you want something that is tight so you can, you know, do frequent trades. So that's what we're trying to focus. But again, it's all about models, especially in our case, that adjust themselves based on exposure, based on liquidity. So even in this case, with a better collateralization system, this is just a big, strong assumption that we're making, but we've seen this by looking at the market. You're going to have more sellers. You're going to have, you know, the arbitrage in the case is going to get filled faster. The spread is going to be tighter. So it's all about that. So I believe that that's going to help a lot. The other issue like that we are thinking about is like we have an AMM, right? What if we build an order book, for example? With the order book, potentially you can even have a better execution if you think about it. Like, you know, it's order book is something like pretty simple like that, but you still need a lot of liquidity and you still need a very good collateralization. Otherwise, people are not going to place orders, right? Or market makers. So to me, like collateralization is definitely the next big step. Once we fix that, I guess the others are kind of like consequence and easier to adjust. But if you don't have like a good collateralization, it's going to be hard to fix the others.
How are you fixing collateralization? Like, I mean, is it what you're saying with like more LPs, or is it more structured products that sort of fix the shorts versus the longs? Or is, you know, I'm a slow guy who went to law school from South Texas, so you got to spell it out for me.
No, collateralization is a good one, and it's not an easy one. It requires a lot of, you know, math, people and mindset. So
it's largely a quant thing, is what you're saying, is figuring out quantitatively on your end.
It's a quant thing, and it's also about how much risk you want to put on the protocol, because we can put collateralization very low, right? So one thing on collateralization is what I mentioned earlier. Like, because we don't have an efficient market, we don't know what is the value of an option. So let me give you like a very straightforward example. If you sell an option right now, like 7 days call option, whatever, this option might cost $10. The same options in a bull market, when implied volatility was 4 times what we've seen today, because today we have an implied volatility of 30. Back in the bull market, it was like over 100, like 120, 140. That was kind of an average at some point. It means that your option is going to be priced way more than 4x. So like if you have like three, you know, like as a 30% volatility today, this thing might cost 10. With 120% volatility, the same asset might cost 150, 160, whatever. Like, you know, I can give you the exact number, but I need some Excel here. So this tells you a lot about what should be the collateral of this option, right? If you try to have a generalizable model that it doesn't know what is the implied volatility in the market, you have to make sure that this is enough collateral in case implied volatility is 140 or in case implied volatility is 130, right? Because it's a generalizable model. And so if this option is worth 150, the collateral of this has to be like, I don't know, at least 450, 500, 600, whatever. But if the option is worth 10, maybe 450 collateral is enough right now, right? And this, as I mentioned before, because we don't have an oracle for this volatility yet, because we don't have enough volumes, it's hard to get this, you know, this number. But in the future, we can go there. You can see like, I don't know, like you can see a risk and all the other competitors on chain. You can get like an average value of what volatility stands at. And you can say, okay, this is where the market is. So the collateral required is that. The other way of fixing it is by margining. So right now, most of the protocols, and risk is one of them, by design, they are independent. So if you have sell an option and buy an options, for example, they are treated as independent actions. There is not, you know, nothing like that tells you like this is the same user. But let me make you an example. If you sell one call and one put on the same strike, on the same expiry, what happens is only one of the two could be worthless at expiry, and one of the two is gonna have the loss, and the other one it doesn't, because you know put and call, they're just moving on the opposite direction, right? So as of today, what we do at risk, and this is not ideal, is we ask you to put collateral on both of them. What we're working on, and this is something that like actually is gonna be live in very soon, we're just gonna ask you to put collateral one of the two, because you know there is no point to collateralize both of them. So those are all the small improvements, but they seem small, but at the end of the game, they're pretty big. And so it's all about getting there in a sense of, you know, better math. You need a liquid market to get, or, you know, this kind of a oracle thing that you can price options in a very good way. Margining. Something we are working on is also sponsoring collateral. So if you want to keep the system, because one thing is like, it's also design decision. Like I was talking with Premia, that is another options protocol, and we're very close to them, right? You can call it a competitor, but at the end of the game, we share a lot of ideas and everything. The approach they're taking is like, they believe that at protocol level, it should be always fully collateralized. They're like, we don't want the system to blow. Like the protocol level should have like all the collateral. At user level though, you can borrow the money, for example, right? But at the protocol level, you put the money there, right? So the thing is, the protocol will be fully collateralized. But as a user, you can borrow money. So effectively, you are not fully collateralized because you're borrowing money somewhere else. And with Risk, we're doing something similar. We're basically enabling the protocol to sponsor your collateral. So you post, I don't know, let's say you post $100, but you can borrow $300 or $400 from the pool. That is something that we're working on as well. So as a user, the collateral is... for you is way lower, but for the system, it's still like a good, decent amount of collateral. So those are like all the things that we're working on. And again, it's a matter of time and a matter of, you know, experimenting, but it's mostly, it's mostly time. We need time, we need to experiment, we need to play with it, we need to, you know, play with a lot of math, we need quant people to figure it out, the hard math behind it, but it's doable, yes. I mean, it's definitely something we can do.
So you mentioned Premia. I guess, like, sort of give us a overview of the competitive landscape for on-chain options, DeFi options. Like, what are people doing differently? Like you said, Premia, you know, one trade-off is the collateralization there. I don't know. Can you give us a quick overview of, you know, when you should use different things? I do know one thing about you is you are like a DeFi collaboration maximalist. So this might be hard for you.
No, I believe in collaboration because, listen, like the options market in DeFi right now is so small that if we keep fighting for what is this market right now, we're going to die, all of us anyway. So there is no point to fight each other. Like the point is, let's build this, you know, industry. Let's educate people. Let's, you know, do it together because we need to grow this industry together. Like there is no way we're going to fight for this small cake. So this is my approach. And I've been, you know, having this from day zero. And again, some of the other protocols are like friendly, like, you know, Premia is an example. Like I talk to them on a regular basis. We enjoy like to discuss, you know, this is like kind of the approach we have in. Right now, I think at least in DeFi options, I'm seeing like two different approach. One is like the kind of like app chain thesis. It's like, I'm going to build Deribit. So same thing of Deribit, like with an order book and trying to get the market makers on my own chain. This is like one of the approach that some of the protocols are taking. Like the main one is Evo. That is basically, you know, the product from Ribbon. Lyra is going with the V, I guess it's the V2. They're going on the same direction. So it's like, we're going to build our own version of Deribit. It's going to be, you know, high performance, but it's going to be on up chain with, you know, we can make a lot of critics on that system by not being composable. By having an up chain, obviously, it's like you're putting some centralization into the mechanism, right? So that's an approach that we've seen. Like, I basically see this as like, I want to build that a bit on chain. The settlement is on chain. It's just a better Deribit in the sense that we try to go that way. The other approach, I think, is more on the composability, you know, kind of like more DeFi approach. And I think that's, for example, what something like Premia is doing. They want to be like very protocol level. They're focusing on building a great protocol out there. And then they want other teams to actually build on top. They want to other teams to contribute and so on. So I think like those are like the two main areas, like app chain thesis, kind of order book on top of it, or more like collaboration, more like composability. Sometimes it's an AMM, sometimes it's like an AMM with an order book, whatever. Like, I'm not going to lie, like order book is something we are exploring as well. We can have an order book on top of the AMM, right? That is something that also Uniswap is basically doing. And the thing is, it's a smart way. Like you have a pool. That is pricing, that is going to be, you know, one of the AMM or like market maker in that sense. But then you're going to have other market makers that they're going to do like with the order book and so on. I think this is a smart way of thinking about the future. I don't think that they are, you know, one is going to exclude the others. So I think like AMM, they have a lot of limits and limitation, but I still believe that for some cases they are important and I think there are going to be some use cases there. But I guess like, yeah, when it comes to options, I think those are like the two main direction that I'm seeing. So as a user, like you can be on app chain with all the bridging, you know, that you know, you're going to lose composability and so on, or you can board, you know, the other way around. I think risk is more like the other way around, like taking on the composability. As I mentioned before, I believe that one day protocol is going to be the biggest risk user. Other protocol trading options. So I believe that, you know, composability is a big trade-off right now. So I'm not into the upchain thesis myself. I don't really understand them. But I mean, there is a use case for sure about that as well.
One really quick thought before we probably move on to a different part of the conversation. It's mostly been like a winner-take-all market for a lot of these on-chain apps, right? Where you saw like Uniswap just blew up and it killed SushiSwap. SushiSwap is basically dead at this point. Like maybe somebody with Blur, OpenSea, I've seen like data going back and forth on that one. But for the most part, it does tend to be that way. And it makes sense, right? Because like if I'm going to log into something and I basically get the same price execution or whatever, over time, someone's going to take over. How do you like think about that in terms of working with other teams out there? How do you think about competitive landscape?
Yeah, I think for Spot, it's very different than derivatives. And for me, like a good example is not options, probably, but like on the perp side. I don't think that a perp is going to win. That's going to win it all. I think there's going to be space for different ones because sometimes you're going to have a better pricing. Because honestly, like it's hard to have a product that is always better when it comes to derivatives. Like sometimes you're going to be more exposed into certain instruments. Some market maker is going to make some, you know, arbitrage on you. Your funding rate when it comes to perps might be, you know, sometimes negative, sometimes positive, sometimes higher, lower. Like I think it's hard to believe that the a derivative is going to be, you know, like perfect and better than all the others. And that's what we also learn from traditional finance. Like there is one Robinhood only. I agree with that. Like, you know, Robinhood is the main one because I think they've done a great job. But what's behind Robinhood, right? There are market makers behind Robinhood. They're pricing those assets. They're pricing those options. Like Robinhood at the end of the game is just like, just an interface for all those actors behind it. So I still believe that there's going to be space for different, you know, platforms, especially when it comes to derivatives. So I see the point on a spot. I think spot is like what you care about. Spot is like just you want to do a swap and you just care about having the price that is closer to what the world is thinking is the right price at that time, right? But we, again, with derivatives, it's way different. Like with options, for example, because you have so many different strikes and expiries, sometimes you can have like a better price on a put on a platform and sometimes it's going to be on a different one. So I believe that there is space for multiple of them. What I believe, though, is like those ones, they have to talk to each other. Like, I really believe in that because arbitrage, for example, arbitrage is a way of, my view on arbitrage is like, it's good for the model. I don't think we have to build a model just based on arbitrage because I think there is something wrong with it. But if you have arbitrage that they got filled, that's a good thing for the system, right? But if to take an arbitrage, you need another place, another venue, right? So as long as you can get an arbitrage on and there are multiple venues, I think that's a good thing. So I guess for derivatives, it's I don't really believe on, you know, a winner takes it all. I believe especially that there's going to be, again, like, you know, different relationship with market makers, different time where, you know, and think about also the asset. Like when you look at the perps, some perps are better for specific asset because they have more liquidity. So if you want a short Frentech now, you can do it on, I don't know, Hyperliquid, but if you want a short Ape, maybe there is another perp that enables you to do that, right? So there is opportunity for all of them when it comes to derivatives, I guess. And I think, again, on derivatives, it's a different from spot market. That's my view. But it's also way smaller market as well, especially when it comes to options. So it's going to be a challenge to see if we can grow the space together. Because again, if you're not able to grow the space together, that's, we don't care about competition. There's going to be no harm. There's going to be like no point to actually trade options in DeFi, right? So that's probably the main challenge to me.
Yeah. So let's switch gears and talk about the CFTC decision with Open, because I know you said you were involved with Open. Have you read the decision at all or the dissent?
Yeah, I've read the decision. I talked to lawyers about it. I have a very good friend that is a very good crypto lawyer as well. It's a very unique one. I think it creates a big precedent on basically DeFi right now. And the main reason I'm saying this is like, first of all, yeah, Open was an exchange, if we can, you know, call it like as an exchange, but the thing they're referring to is Squid. Squid was one of the latest product built by Open. Squid was a subset of smart contract, basically like the, you know, just to give an idea what that was, it's like it was tracking the price of it and putting it into a square. So it was like, it was a product that if you long it, so if you buy Squid and basically like the price of it is going up, these things is going up squared, right? So it's like the convexity I was explaining before, like when you basically buy a call. So Squid is a subset of smart contract that had this kind of concept behind it, but it was using Uniswap pool as an exchange. So when you trade Squid, effectively you are going on, you know, Open UI, you wanted to long a squid, you long a squid, but what happened behind the scenes, it was a Uniswap V3 or V2, I don't even remember, pool giving you the price and basically just, you know, selling the squid and the other asset or the other way around. So this creates a big precedent because, you know, the claim from CFTC was that Open was running an exchange when in a matter of fact, it was running a front end with a unique product that they built, but the exchange per se was Uniswap. So that's actually a big thing to think about it because that's the venue of it, right? Looking at the front end, there is another big precedent here that it's like Open had basically geo-blocking. So if you were a US resident, you were not supposed to use it, so you're like kicking out. They also had terms of condition, like you as a user, you accept the terms that you're not a US resident, right? So you first geo-blocking, but also let's say that didn't work or you were abroad or whatever, like you accept terms of conditions. And that's pretty much a best practice that everyone is using in the space right now to just limit these US participation in the market.
Yeah, gotta limit, gotta block the US, gotta block North Korea, gotta block Iran, you know, all the dangerous countries.
Yeah, that's pretty much like, you know, kind of the practice that it's been using for front ends. In reality, that didn't work either. Like, and the CFTC was like, those are like the actions in place were not enough to limit US participation. So I think that case specifically creates a big precedent on the space. So now it's like, you don't really have a guidelines on how to comply when you're a DeFi project with them. Like the thing is like the only guidelines that you know, it's like you should KYC everyone pretty much. That's the way you do it. Just KYC every user. And that's, you know, we know it's not even double. Like even eventually, like anyone can go either scan or arb scan and use it. Like there's no way you can enforce that, right? So I think it's a big case. For like different reasons, I think it creates a very unique precedent here. I'm usually very optimistic, but when I see stuff like that, it's hard to be optimistic. Like especially from US, like the first thing that I thought when I read that, I was like, okay, just you know, whatever. Like we have to do everything to make sure the US is not gonna use us anymore, right? But when you think about go deep or say why Open was, for example, fine versus others, and you look deep and it's like it was a US team, they are like a US company. So what happened there is, okay, they found a US team with a US company doing DeFi. But if you think about what is the, you know, like what is the big problem of this? It's like you losing people from this country to build DeFi, like, you know, that's to build innovation. That's the main thing. Like some people just going to be like, there is no point right now to build in this space. Like who wants to risk it all, right? So that's the main issue. Like US is losing a big opportunity to get into this market. That's to me is the big issue. And I don't see a friendly approach right now from any of these US. I don't even know how to call them. Like what is CFTC? It's like an association. It's like a regulatory, whatever. Regulator, whatever, like agency, there is no friendly approach. And that's again, like who's gonna be the main, like the main problem of this is just gonna be you losing teams building on it. You're losing power, you're losing your competitive advantage versus like, you know, innovation and technology. Because Squid, I mean, my people may have a different opinion, but it was an absolutely talented team. Very strong team. It was absolutely passionate about DeFi. They were very OG. They built a product that I consider an innovation. Some people might not consider it, but it was effectively an innovation in space. And now what is the result of this? It's like people not, you know, they're not incentivized to do that anymore. That's, I guess, is the big issue I see about all this story.
So you know the team, and I saw a bunch of people say online, including some of my friends, how come they didn't fight this? Because, I mean, to be fair, they probably wouldn't win in the CFTC because it's quite clear, like all of these things that are coming down are entirely partisan votes, and it is 100% Democrats voting for them and 100% Republicans voting against them. And like, it's actually quite clear if you actually look, like you know, this is a little bit of a theme of this podcast lately, but it's coming from the White House, and the White House is telling like the regulatory agency what to do here. And, you know, these people, like the commissioners, actually do serve at the pleasure of the president. So, like, especially the Democrat one. So they don't really have any choice. So, like, I guess that's my question is why did they choose not to fight it? Any color there?
I spoke to them. I think it's going to a personal level, right? Like, it's at the end of the game, it's a personal decision that you make. It's like you go fight, and you know, it's you're fighting against a government agency, like, you know, it's getting into like some risk. On the other side, I think it just defocus you from everything that you were wanting to do as a founder. Like, I don't remember like the timing of this, but we're talking about months, like 6-9 months that they're basically just talking to lawyers, talking to regulators, like talking to, and at the end of the game, that's not what you enjoy as a builder, right? That's what you enjoy. It's like, I want to build a product. I want to put it out there. I want users to use it. I want, you know, solve the challenges I talk to you like for over this call. Like, I want to solve the collateralization challenge. That's something that excites us, not talking to lawyers. So again, I think it goes to a personal level. I'm sure some people are gonna fight. Some people just gonna be like, listen, I've been doing this for 9 months, talking to lawyers every day, trying to fight. And at the end of the game, it's like, what am I gonna do? It's not even fun to build anymore. And once you are like, you know, under the radar, you're always in a very, you know, it's like, I don't know, like mining, like you're in a minefield, right? Like, you don't know how to move. You don't know what's going on. And you're just putting away all the, you know, fun and excitement building. Again, I think it goes a lot to a personal level. Like, probably some people decide to fight. Some people probably just decide to say, you know what, as long as I'm passionate about the space, but I'm not passionate about talking to regulators every day, right? So I guess that's probably what happened to Open in that sense. They just got tired of talking to lawyer every single day and just focusing on that. And what are you going to do? Like, even in the next months, it's just say, I want to build a product, not, you know, not doing all this noise. And that's one of the thing, like, we all agree. It's like, building is hard. You have to facilitate, not making harder. Like, if you are like a regulator, if you want to focus on innovation, help builders to build, not make their life harder, because it's already a big challenge. It's already tough. Like, you know, you have to focus with security, and like, especially crypto is super hard. Like, not enough users, not enough volume, security issues. You have to get the best developers on board. You have so many challenges. And then you also have to add this. It's just like, at some point you just get drained and like, okay, well, you know what? It's not worth it. I get it. I mean, I don't know what I will do. Probably I'm also in a different age that I'm like, probably fight, because I think it's fun at some point. As I mentioned before, it's like a new challenge. So, you know, let me learn a bit more about like, you know, regulation and law, but I don't know, maybe not. I'm not, you know, it's hard.
Yeah. I mean, I read the Commissioner Mersinger's dissent, and she basically says, like, it was like, you know, Texas, we have our come and take it flag, which is from the Texas Revolution. Her entire, I think it was technically a public statement, maybe not technically a dissent, but her entire statement is come and take it. This CFTC decision is total nonsense. She points out that CFTC doesn't have jurisdiction over this market like it says it does. She points out that basically they're just sending everything overseas, and that the CFTC has a mandate to foster innovation and not do enforcement first, and yet they're not doing that. She points out that they put out a strategic plan like a year or two ago that was going to foster innovation and do all these things, specifically about DeFi, and then they just skipped all of that and went to enforcement first. And then she points out as well, actually this is the first thing she points out, is they made them vote on all three of these actions together because it wasn't just the Open one. And there's no reason why, like they're very different circumstances. And the only reason why is just political decision, like for marketing purposes, basically. And, you know, it's clear that like this is not a well-founded or well-substantiated decision, and it could be fought. But like I understand where the open team is coming from, because once you've been fighting and talking to lawyers, it just gets very, very draining. And probably their startup was already dead anyway, right? Because the CFTC has effectively killed it. And so they could choose to try to limp on to try to fight the CFTC for the good of everyone else, but they're at the cost of their own personal health, or they could, you know, just give up. And I get why they gave up. It's sad, but that's what fighting the government is. I mean, that's the decision.
The thing about Open is actually like they also had a very you know, like strong cap table, like some of the big names out there. I think like Paradigm, they led their like Series A round. So I was probably expecting to be more, I don't know, like covered in that sense, also by, you know, like the space per se. You know, that's something that I believe should be like value from when you get like, you know, one of the biggest VC in the space to back you. So like probably you expect them to help if something like that happens, right? So that's to me is something that I'm not, I don't know what happened. I don't see what is, I don't have an idea. I don't have an opinion. I just like thought that there was some of the value add that I will expect from some of those people. It was like a very Silicon Valley base as well. You know, that's like what you fostered all the innovation. So it was one of those teams that I will probably expect to have like everyone on board to actually help them to defend. But I don't know what happened, to be honest. And again, I get the team. Like, I understand them. If you remove the fund from building, there is no point of building. That's simple as that.
If you were an American, would you leave America?
I will definitely leave America. I will definitely, like, not have a company in the U.S. That's definitely something that I will never, never do that. Like, I don't see the point of having, like, a U.S. company when you are in a crypto project at this point. There are many other regulations that are very friendly to crypto. So there is no point for an American company. I get like if people want to live here for like personal reasons, it's fine. But at least like you can have a company abroad. That's the first thing to do, I assume.
Better going on. Yeah. So outside, I guess for risk personally, do you feel like this has changed your calculation? You know, I actually, when y'all launched and blocked the U.S., like geo-blocked the U.S., I thought that was silly, because I still weirdly had faith in that the Biden administration crackdown was going to be on bad actors, and instead we found out that it's really just trying to criminalize the entire space. Yeah, like how has it changed it for you? You probably talked to lawyers, so, though, like you said you've been talking to lawyers already. It's wasting everybody's time, even globally.
Yeah. So from a product level, I think we're going to go with our direction, right? It's like our goal is to improve this options market, to build it and so on. I think this is going to make changes on how people are going to approach the product development. Like protocol is one thing, front end is a different thing. Like those are like some of the, I've started to see some approaches there, like people not doing front end anymore or like decentralizing the front end to different teams, but just focusing on protocol. I think that's something that probably in the future we're going to see. Like in terms of risk, I still believe that for now, like the approach that we take, we're going with the same direction. But something that I definitely am scared of is institutional participation. Because if you're an institutional and you have all your, you know, I mentioned this at the beginning of the call. I worked in investment banking, like, you know, an American investment banking, one of the biggest, and 60-70% of my time was just doing internal committees, right? And that was to give money or like lend money or whatever to the biggest Italian companies or like European companies. Now, think about the same thing about using a DeFi protocol. There is no way that an institutional is going to be like, oh, yeah, this protocol has been similar to the other one because it's using Uniswap and then, you know, through CFTC. There is no way that you're going to have those actors to participate in the market with all this, you know, situation going on. If you're an institutional and you see that, because, for example, we build on top of a piece of open infrastructure, not the Squid, the Pichu, whatever, So if they're going to do due diligence, they're going to see the name. They're going to be like, oh, like, you know, do you have like something that is, you know, against CFTC? What's going on? Like, it's just making everything harder. And institutional participation is something that we, as an industry, we should embrace, right? That's something that we should be happy about it. Like, we having like institutional money into the space. And I'm not talking about, you know, VCs and so on. I'm talking about traders. I'm talking people buy insurance, like using option and so on. And this is going to be hard. I'm not going to lie. And US is the main one, you know, it's the main place in the world for like hedge funds and all those actors. So it's not like excluding US from a retail perspective, I guess, is fine. Excluding US from an institutional perspective is not fine. It's like you basically limiting yourself to, you know, what other institution, like, what are you going to get? Russians on board now, like with, you know, the human worst. What are you going to do? Like, you're going to get, as you said, like North Korea people, like, it's hard, or like China. So like, even like, you know, embracing like institutional, it's going to be hard. And that's probably what changed a lot in terms of like our approach to the market.
I have a feeling that institutions will find a way, because where there is yield, the shadow banking system often, like they figure out how to funnel liquidity around. But yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, but you said something there, like, where is yield? Yield is not here anymore, right? So that's probably the main issue. Probably it's not the regulation. It's like, let's find a way to get yield to people, and then we figure it out.
I guess let's talk about other challenges of building. You did tell me, you know, I think it was during the USDC DPEG that six months ago, that one of the biggest, you know, this industry had all sorts of challenges that others don't have, you know, like from previous startups. And obviously the DPEG was a big one. Obviously dealing with the legal and the regulatory is one. But then it's surprising to me, you know, y'all launched Risk Beyond, and all of a sudden, wait, the USDC on Arbitrum is not the USDC that they pressured you into using. Like, what's up with that? I don't even think most people know about this, because unless you're like doing things on chain, all of a sudden there's two USDCs on Arbitrum, and they're telling everyone to use the one that nobody uses.
This is one of the crazy things about this space. It's like, the tooling is not here. Like, we try to make our life harder. So we had a Risk Alpha that it was like our first product out there. And we were running on Arbitrum with USDC deposit. Then we received a message from the Arbitrum team, like, you know, one of these official communication about Circle now as native support on Arbitrum. So what that means is like, you know, when you use Circle, you can basically, you know, mint, let's say, USDC by depositing some USD, whatever. And you can do that directly on Arbitrum. So you don't need to use a bridge as it was happening before. So what that means, that at some point on Arbitrum, we have two different USDC. We have the USDC.E, that it was the bridged version of USDC. So it basically was USDC on mainnet that were bridged to layer 2 Arbitrum. Or we have the native USDC. So we received this message like a week before we were planning to go live. So the thing is like, what are we going to do? It's like, should we stick to the USDC? But like, it seems that people are, you know, like, that, I don't know, like, why you should use something that is not native when there is a native version of it. I was like, okay, let's go for USDC, USDC native, right? And the reason was, we build this right now, we deploy this right now, we need to choose the asset. We're going to collect liquidity. If we want to change mine 3 months from now, 6 months from now, it's going to be a mess. Like, you have to, you know, migrate all the liquidity. So it's a big decision. So it's like, okay, let's talk with other teams, let's see what they're doing. And everyone seemed to be like, okay, we should go with native. But again, that means migrating liquidity, building new versions. So most of the team were like, oh yeah, for our beach, we're going to use the native. But, you know, that's going to take time. So what happened at the end was like, we chose a USDC native, and a lot of people needed to bridge money. Some people lost small amount of money on the bridging. Like, you know, it was not 101. It was like sometimes like 99.8 or whatever. So some people had to, you know, and then gas on top of it. So those are like all the challenges that in this space are crazy. Like, They makes everyone's life so hard. There is not a single advantage of all this mess. Like users, it's not good for users. Builders, it's not good for builders. It's just like, it's such a big mess. But because of the pace of evolution that we have in, I get it. Like when Arbitrum build their own first product, they needed some USDC. What you do, you just bridge. You're not going to waste Circle for months and months and months to build the infrastructure, right? So we're going so fast that at some point that's the system is breaking. Simple as that. So yeah, USDC is like one of my favorite stories because it's something like so simple, but it made everyone's life harder. That's it.
And for very little.
Yeah, for like nothing. Yeah, there is like not a single value for users, not a single value for the protocol to have one or the other. It's like it's completely the same thing. And you know the funny story? We also had to build a wrapper. When we do the edge, we use GMX because GMX didn't have USDC native yet. We had to build a wrapper to swap USDC on Uniswap, get the USDC, deposit into GMX, do the trade, and go back. So like this takes like not much time, but still you have to one guy, one resource to do all this, you know, wrapper for that. Just no reason.
What a mess.
It is a mess.
Crazy. I guess let's close with a more optimistic note. And I guess that should be, give us your prediction for when on-chain DeFi options cuts out the centralized exchange middleman and flips it. And, you know, we get rid of the middleman with all of the counterparty risk and, you know, all of the many hacks, like centralized exchange hacking risk. And have a fairer, you know, less risky version. What do you think? How far away are we?
I think it's like my answer might be more simple than you can think of, but I honestly believe that in the next bull market, we're going to start to see a real utilization of options. I don't know what the next bull market is going to be, and I don't know if there is going to be a next one. Like, that's a different question that we can talk about it. But I really believe...
Oh, there will be another one.
I mean, for people that have been around this space, we know that there could be another one. Like, you know, I've seen already two, and I think there's going to be a third one. So, yeah, I mean, probably you've been longer than me, so you saw all the others as well. But the reason
there will
I'm
be another is, one. There might be a lot more pain first. I mean, I actually don't think we've seen any sort of pain yet. So,
oh, like, no, this is
Evan's
not pain.
A pain maxi.
Yeah,
this
I
is
think
not
we're
pain.
Have, yeah, yeah.
I mean, Evan... ETH, because that's my reference, it went like not even close to 1,000. That's not pain. That's the lowest we got this, like, you know, in this bear market, what it was, like 1,200, something like that. That's not pain. Pain was below 100, that it happened the day that I was playing with MakerDAO right before COVID. That was pain. And, you know, get liquidated on MakerDAO. But yeah, now my answer is I really believe that it's a matter of time, but I believe that bull market is going to be one of those catalysts where people are going to start to trade more option, even though I don't know if that's going to be retail, but it's going to be, as you mentioned earlier, like when there is yield, there will be institutionals. When there is yield and, like, you know, bull market, there will be a lot of builders. Because right now, like every time, like, you know, we still a lot of builders in the space, but I remember going to events 3 years ago and going to events now. Like 3 years ago, so you get this key right out of like college and it's like, oh, I'm going to build something in crypto because it's so fun. There's so much money, right? That's good and bad. I think sometimes there is more bad than good in that. But still, you're going to have those teams. They're going to build products on top of options. You know, you're going to have more institutional participation. And that's going to be a big catalyst for DeFi overall, for DeFi options. I think that's going to be the time where the growth of this is going to be like way more higher than the growth of something like Deribit. Like Deribit is going to grow, like for sure, but I don't think they're going to have an impact of all this like composability of other teams building on top of, you know, who knows what's going to be the next crazy thing that we came out. But composability, I think, is one of the things that when we are in a very bull market, people care a lot. You want to be something fast, because there are so much opportunities out there. You want to build fast. You want to integrate with some other products. You want to get your own user base. Everyone is going to, you know, a lot of users just going to be excited about using the protocol. So I guess that's the, you know, the catalyst in my view. I don't know if we're going to flip that a bit. Maybe, I hope. I think we're going to do everything we can in our control to actually flip it. But I think that's going to be a big time where we're going to see like real growth, at least in the option space.
Well, that's a bullish note. Let's close on that. You know, next bull market, on-chain options, flip centralized options. Where can people find you on learn about more about you, more about Risk?
Yeah, Risk is simple. It's like rysk.finance is the website and Twitter and everything. It's like rysk. By the way, the name, Evan, it came from yield, because it was a bull market with a lot of yield, and we were like, okay, but people should know that there is a risk. So I was like, how can I get yield knowing the risk? So that's how we got into this name. So for people, just like, remember that if there is yield, there is also risk.
More things I should have known when I invested.
Well, I mean, the origin of name is not a big deal, but yeah, like Risk Finance. For myself, I have my Twitter that is like Dan DeFi. I don't even know how to spell that, I guess, but people are smarter than me.
Put it in the show
notes.
Your
listeners.
Great.
Cool. Well, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, guys. This was a fun one. Thanks, guys.
Like, subscribe, all of those good things. Retweet, share it with your friends, and we will see you next time.
Yeah, thanks.
Adios.